This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's a pleasure to have you with us on our radio Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. The same time we're on the air, we are streaming at prairiepublic.org, and you can always find Main Street After Week broadcast at the same place, prairiepublic.org. And today we're starting our show with a familiar voice to Main Street listeners. As a matter of fact, a familiar voice in general across the state of North Dakota. It's Clay Jenkinson. He's a noted scholar and historian and a specialist on a couple of characters from history that are very important to our country. Of course, Thomas Jefferson. He does the Thomas Jefferson Hour on our network and across the nation. And Theodore Roosevelt, our 26th president, and that is the subject of today's discussion. Clay, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be with you. We're all hunkering down a little bit here, but you know the electronic revolution is going to allow us to get through this.
Well, as you mentioned, the coronavirus pandemic has changed a lot of behaviors, and I am talking to you from my home studio today, and I'll be sending these files back to Master Control to be assembled into the show that we call Main Street that airs across the state at 3 Central. Well, we're going to talk about something that actually came out of a symposium that you and I talked about 3 years ago. That was Theodore Roosevelt, Naturalist in the Arena, which was held at Dickinson State back in 2017. Give us a sense of what that event was like and why it was important to you.
Thanks for asking. You know, we do these annual Theodore Roosevelt symposia on the campus of Dickinson State. We've done 15 of them. They've been extraordinary. We've had the greatest presenters from all over the country and even all over the world come to talk about different themes in the life and achievement of one of the most colorful persons who was ever in public leadership in the United States, Theodore Roosevelt. And in 2017, as you say, the theme was T.R., the Naturalist. He wanted to be a professional naturalist and only turned to politics when he decided that that curriculum wasn't quite in keeping with his own views of nature and wilderness and conservation. And so we had really extraordinary presenters, including Char Miller of Pomona College. He's an endowed chair of environmental studies. He's a prolific author. He's an expert on Roosevelt's friend Gifford Pinchot. And on Saturday, we always go out to Medora and to the Badlands and have our last discussion there. It's very informal. And the people who come, you know, get to ask questions they might not be willing to ask in a big auditorium. And towards the end of it, I looked over at him, and there were four, I think, scholars on the dais. And he looked over at me, and we sort of said simultaneously, there's a book in this. The presentations were so good, uniformly excellent, that we decided that this could be a book. And so we approached the University of Nebraska, and they generously agreed to print the volume, and Char Miller and I edited it. And every one of the presenters who had come to that symposium touched up their lectures a little, you know, gave them some footnotes and added a paragraph here and there. And then we invited a couple of other scholars from around the world to contribute other aspects of T.R., the Naturalist. And that book just came out, University of Nebraska Press, and it's called Theodore Roosevelt, Naturalist in the Arena.
Well, that title, of course, is familiar, and we should also mention that it's available now and that you were going to be on a book tour, but of course the realities of the world today have changed a lot of schedules, including yours. How did you and Char Miller distribute the work to create this piece?
Well, we encouraged all the presenters to, you know, to go back and make another run at their lectures, and they did. And then I edited them, and he edited them, and we each found different things to suggest. And so that got them into shape. And I knew of another presenter, a man named Elliot West from the University of Arkansas, who had given a previous keynote lecture at one of our symposia about Roosevelt's young life as a wilderness lover. And he was involved when he was a young man with the eugenics movement, which has, of course, been very seriously discredited. But he graduated out of it eventually. And so we wanted Elliot West to sort of place Roosevelt's intellectual formation, and he did. It's a brilliant lecture. And then Char Miller found two other presenters. And then I had also given a lecture at T.R. Island in the Potomac at Washington, D.C., on the 50th anniversary of that memorial to Theodore Roosevelt. And we used that. Char suggested we use that as the sort of the the epilogue to the volume. So all those pieces came together, and we co-wrote the introduction, and we farmed out the index, because we knew that neither one of us had time, and two people can't index. It's a 225-page book, and it's got a great press, University of Nebraska. It's illustrated, and here's one really important piece of it, Doug. The images for the thing came from Dickinson State University's TR Center, the archives at the Theodore Roosevelt Center. We're digitizing the entire papers of Theodore Roosevelt. We put them all together, these images that pertain to T.R. the Naturalist, and those are in the book. So this is sort of a monument to the great work that Sharon Kilzer and other members of our staff at the T.R. Center have been doing to digitize the entire world of Roosevelt's papers, which includes newspaper clippings and diaries and letters in and letters out and cartoons and film clips and pieces of audio and photographs too.
The accessibility of history is one of the wonders of the 21st century, I think. How is the book put together? How do you tell the story? Is there an arc to it? Does it go linearly through his lifetime? How does it work?
One of our presenters at that symposium was Darren Lundy, who is at the Smithsonian, and he actually himself is a naturalist, and he had given a really outstanding lecture, the keynote, in 2017 on T.R. the Naturalist. So it follows Roosevelt from his earliest childhood until his death. When he was around 9, he was on Lower Broadway at a store, and he saw this creature, this seal, that was lying dead on a slab, and he became fascinated by it. And so he then measured it with his measuring equipment and took notes on it and tried to buy it, and eventually got the skull when the thing was finally completely rotted, and it became the basis of what he called the Theodore Roosevelt Museum of Natural History. He even had labels printed up for this, and this was going to be his life. So Darren Lundy gives us a kind of a chronological look at the entire achievement of Roosevelt, and then we go in for separate chapters. So Char Miller writes about that key relationship with Gifford Pinchot, who was the U.S. Forester. We have a wonderful essay on T.R. and John Muir when they went together to Yosemite, and Roosevelt spent 3 days with the greatest naturalist and wilderness man of the country in Yosemite. He said it was the best 3 days of his life, of course. And I wrote one on T.R. and the saving of the bison. The buffalo came very near to extinction around the turn of the century, and everyone assumed that it would go extinct. But Roosevelt and Gifford Pinchot and George Bird Grinnell and Scotty Phillip and a range of other people went to work on this, including one of my heroes, William Hornaday. And Hornaday is really the man who saved the buffalo from extinction. And he did so by going out northwest of Miles City and seeing the killing fields. And when he was there in 1886, he had a conversion experience and decided to devote much of the rest of his life to saving this creature. And so all these different essays were contributed by the presenters who were at the symposium or people that we recruited. So we wanted to have a complete picture of Roosevelt the Naturalist and not leave any holes.
Well, you mentioned something that just caught my ear now. You talk about Hornaday and Muir and Pinchot and Grinnell, people that were very prominent in the naturalist and environmental and conservation, I guess, movement of the late 19th and early 20th century. How important was that moment in our history?
Oh, my, Doug. You know, I once asked Charles Wilkinson, who is the great environmental professor of law at the University of Colorado in Boulder, at a conference I was hosting. I said to him, Charles, is it possible to exaggerate Theodore Roosevelt's contribution to American conservation? And he said, absolutely not. You know, that he is the key player, that if there had been no Roosevelt, it's hard to think that Taft would have done this, or Woodrow Wilson, or McKinley, or anybody else. And, you know, the second round of it came from FDR, who was self-consciously trying to imitate his fifth cousin, Theodore Roosevelt. Roosevelt's importance is staggering. He set aside 230 million acres of the public domain is national park, national forest, national wildlife refuge, national monument, national game preserve. It's unbelievable what he did. And he also helped to save the buffalo. And he helped to create the management protocols that we use in the national park system. He and George Bird Grinnell created the Boone and Crockett Club. And the Boone and Crockett Club was our first non-government environmental foundation. And they worked hard to save Yellowstone from economic development and railroads were going to go in and luxury hotels for the rich, and mining was probably going to take place there. And Roosevelt and Grinnell and the Boone and Crockett Club stepped in and said, no, the national parks are not going to be for the elite. They're not going to be for industrial development. They belong to the people, and we want every single human being, whether it's Nelson Rockefeller or Doug Hamilton, to be able to go into the national parks and have an equally satisfying experience. There's not going to be a class system in our national parks, and we're not going to make them places of multiple use. They're going to be places for the recreation of the human spirit. So Roosevelt was a great man, and he surrounded himself with other extraordinary individuals who understood what was important. You know, he didn't always agree with John Muir, but he always listened to John Muir, and he became the greatest conservationist in American presidential history without any rivals, except possibly Jimmy Carter, and that's because Carter set aside, or helped set aside, a very large chunk of Alaska.
But this was a time of intense resource extraction as well. I mean, the iron ore mines in the northern U.S., oil was coming online in lots of places. Were national parks or these kinds of reserves that were federally ordained ways to sort of let people loose in other parts of the country?
Well, yes. So Roosevelt was a pragmatist. He didn't think of himself as a preservationist like Muir. He would not have agreed with Henry David Thoreau's philosophy of these things, or probably the modern environmental movement. He wanted wise, scientifically based, sustained use. And what he saw was that we were skinning the West. We were cutting down the forests without replacing them. We were mining in Colorado and Wyoming and California and just leaving these tailings to poison the water supply. And we were overgrazing the public domain with cattle on ranches like the ones that Roosevelt himself had in the Badlands of North Dakota. And he thought, this is insane. Just as we're really becoming the most prosperous and powerful nation on Earth, we're skinning our landscape and we're drawing down the great resource treasury that North America represents. So we're going to have to conserve it. We're going to have to find ways to make sure that our children's children and their children will have access to these resources too. And so that was the basis of it. And of course, if you take the national wilderness, which didn't come about until the 1970s, but if you set that aside, as no one can go in except on foot, and then you have the national parks where you can be in, but you have to stay on the roads. And then you have, say, the national forest lands, the grasslands of North Dakota, where people have more economic capacities, more possibilities to mine for gravel or for oil or for coal. And then you get down to the Bureau of Land Management, which has a much more welcoming philosophy for economic development. So we've created this system of tiers that the most magnificent and fragile things in North America we're trying to protect forever. And there are lots of them. I mean, our national park system and our wilderness system are the glory of the world. And then we have a second tier where some economic activity is okay, but it has to be done under carefully controlled federal regulation and user groups like grazing associations and so on. And then we have the BLM, which controls, you know, a very, very large swath of the American West in places like Utah and Wyoming and Nevada. And it's management philosophy is, of course, we need economic development, but it's going to have to be done in a somewhat responsible way. It's not just a open season on those resources. So that's the political settlement that works for the United States. It's under some attack now. We'll see how it holds up in the 21st century. But a lot of this is Roosevelt's view that it would be silly to lock up the West, but let's lock up the very best of it.
Humanities scholar Clay Jenkinson is the editor, along with Chara Miller, of the new book, Theodore Roosevelt, Naturalist in the Arena. Publishers Weekly, Clay, describes your book as a revealing and sometimes critical view of the 26th president. So let's get some examples of the critical stuff.
Well, as I said, Elliot West, who was a magnificent scholar, one of the very best historians in the country, explored Roosevelt's flirtation with the eugenics movement. And that sounds more awful now than it was then, but it's awful no matter really when you look at it. But Roosevelt graduated out of this, and he realized that this was not a responsible path. But what Elliot West shows is that so many of those early conservationists were eugenicists, that they were somehow born of similar motives and intellectual impulses, and so they needed to be separated. And eventually they were. And the second theme, which is one that I address in my essay on the buffalo, is that many of our public lands, our national parks, our national forests, our national game preserves, were carved out of Indian lands. And so, you know, you're looking for a national park, say, like Glacier in Montana, and you say, well, the Flatheads and the Blackfeet aren't really using it in any significant way. So this is like free. We have a special license. We're not displacing any white landholders with deeds to this land, or very few of them. And so these are easy pickings for national forests and national parks and so on. And a great deal of that happened. If you could have an overlay map of the Indian reservations as they existed, say in 1872, when Yellowstone was made our first national park, and then you looked at all of the national parks that have come in since, around 59 of them, a very large number of them essentially confiscated lands that were sovereign to one Indian tribe after the next. For example, Badlands National Park in South Dakota appropriated land from the Lakota, and as you know, the Lakota pushed back, and even in my lifetime, Lakotas have occupied parts of Badlands National Park and put up roadblocks and required people who come into them to at least acknowledge the Lakota's overarching sovereignty in such places. So that's another area in which we're not happy to be critical about Roosevelt, but we believe this is really the philosophy of the Theodore Roosevelt Center at Dickinson State, which is winning national and international acclaim for this. But our philosophy is, warts and all, that there's no point in looking at Roosevelt as an unambiguous hero. We need to look at him as a man of his times, as a human being with strengths and weaknesses, as somebody who made political mistakes but also had enormous political successes, as somebody who traded the rights of some for the benefits of others. In other words, he's like any other human being who has to make big decisions about important resources and so on. And it would be a really irresponsible thing for us to do at the Theodore Roosevelt Center to simply make him a kind of paper doll hero, you know, the man of San Juan Hill and the man on Mount Rushmore. So we get some criticism for this, by the way, because there are people that want Roosevelt to be a superhero. But we feel very strongly that the more we tell the truth as we understand it, the better service we're actually doing to presidential history, to Roosevelt studies, and to, as you know, America's unfolding reassessment of the things we all thought we knew when we were back in grade school.
Theodore Roosevelt National Park in western North Dakota is awfully close to a very important resource play. How do you think the 26th president would view the adjacency of that to the park with his name?
Well, that's a good question. So in my essay at the end of this book, I talk about Roosevelt and monuments, and he did not really want a monument in Washington, D.C., or he was against statues. In fact, our governor, Hanna, of North Dakota, wrote him and said, we're going to put up a statue of you on the Capitol grounds. Is that okay? And I quoted in this book, Roosevelt wrote back and said, no, that's a mistake. It's too early, for one thing. I'm still alive, and history needs to make some assessments about, you know, whether I deserve such things. But also, he said, wouldn't it be more appropriate to put up a statue of pioneers, of people who actually did the hard work and struggle to make North Dakota happen? So he was surprisingly humble about this, and the family has always been a little bit edgy about monuments to Roosevelt. But, you know, I'm sure he would be glad that the only national park that's named for a human being is named for him, and it's exactly in his old stomping grounds in western North Dakota. And the 70,000 acres of TR National Park in three units are protected against economic development. But just outside the perimeter, as you well know, Doug, it's national forest land or private land. And there, the development protocols are looser. And so you can see from Buck Hill in the south unit of the park, many, many oil-based industrial installations in Cottonwood Campground, which is the only campground in the south unit. You can hear the traffic on Interstate 94 through the night. This is a somewhat compromised park. And there is now, as you probably know, there is a proposal to do wholesale, sort of over the moon, oil development between the south unit of the national park and the north unit, including just around and embracing the Elkhorn Ranch unit. Now, that all may be changing because the price of oil has plummeted to around $30 per gallon, and nobody can develop that oil at that price. But I don't think this is going to go away. So what would Roosevelt think? Well, we try to avoid weighing in on that sort of a question at the TR Center because, A, we just don't know. And as I've said, he was for sustained conservation, wise use, and that for him included economic development. So, you know, some of this is probably fine. I think that Wayne Stengem's proposal of a few years ago of designating some special or extraordinary places and tiptoeing around them, not prohibiting development, but tiptoeing around them, would have suited Theodore Roosevelt perfectly well. But we just finally don't know what he would think. But I think he would think it's pretty hard to really feel you're in the wilderness when you can hear an 18-wheeler roaring by on Interstate 94, or when you can see the flaring at seven or eight different wells from Buck Hill.
We've been talking about Clay Jenkinson's new book. He co-edited it with Char Miller, Theodore Roosevelt, Naturalist in the Arena. Clay, you're also working on a new film about Roosevelt in popular culture. We've got a couple minutes left. Can you bring us up to date on that?
Yeah, the film is an amazing project that Dickinson State helped to create. The film is by Michael Cullinane, who is an American, but he's actually working in a British university now. And he contacted us because he wanted to make a film about TR Island. TR Island has been there for 50 years. I got to give that speech on that anniversary, and he wanted to do a documentary because most people don't know that Roosevelt has a monument in Washington, D.C. And so the film is called The Man on the Island, and it's almost an hour long. We're hoping to bring it to North Dakota once this plague clears, and we want to show it at the Fargo Theater and in other places. We played a role in it. I got to interview Michael Cullinane, who's the lead, and Dickinson State provided its image base, as usual, in high-resolution photographs so that they could be incorporated into the film. One of the first things we did when we created the TR Center was get a grant to work with six national park properties, including our own TR National Park, but also TR Island, to digitize their holdings, including their photographic base. And so we were in a unique position at the TR Center to be able to help fulfill this project, and we're proud of it. And so that's something else that we've been able to do. And my point is that, you know, we may or may not have a TR National Library anytime soon. I do believe we will in western North Dakota. But meanwhile, the TR Center is going about its humble but extremely important business of digitizing all of Roosevelt's papers. And in addition to that, we serve as an advisor to projects like Cullinane's film. We're producing publications like this book, Theodore Roosevelt, the Naturalist in the Arena. We do exhibits, and of course, we do our annual symposia. So we're doing the hard work of disseminating the good news and our explorations of Roosevelt to a much wider audience than can appear in that auditorium every September.
Clay Jenkinson is the co-editor of Theodore Roosevelt, Naturalist in the Arena, and as you mentioned, working on a new film about Roosevelt and popular culture. It's always a pleasure to talk with the North Dakota native son and humanities scholar Clay Jenkinson. Thanks for joining us today.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you, and I hope to see you in person one of these days.
Likewise. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, sir.
Coming up on Main Street, a Conversations on Healthcare podcast excerpt about legislation moving through Congress to deal with the coronavirus pandemic. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. As Congress works on economic stimulus legislation, Governor Burgum says he has thoughts about what should be in it. Burgum is suggesting money toward unemployment. He says that could mean changing the benefit ratios.
Instead of paying somebody 75% of their pay, maybe you're paying 100% of their pay through that unemployment. That would help support the economy in terms of maintaining incomes and maintaining people's ability to pay their mortgages and maintain consumer demand and all the things that would help support our economy come back quickly.
The other suggestion is a block grant to each state.
Instead of the federal government sitting around and arguing over all the policy approaches on how to spend $1 trillion, you know, send out a check to states, and then states could figure out where they need it, because each state's needs are going to be different.
Burgum says he believes on block grants there is unanimity among the governors. And North Dakota's Department of Human Services says the behavioral health clinics and regional human service centers remain open and are serving clients.
We do restrict visitors in terms of into our crisis units, and we do pre-screening, but all services in the regional human service centers remain open. Similarly, the state hospital, we are still open. We have restricted visitors entirely, but we are not refusing any admissions. As far as the Life Skills and Transition Center in Grafton, again, we are not restricting admissions or reducing admissions, but we are restricting visitors, and we have limited some of our community-based programs through there.
State Human Services Director Chris Jones says his department is working with the counties to make sure those regional centers do remain open.
One of the large redesigns that happened over the last session was moving from 53 counties to 19 human service zones. It is an amalgamation and sometimes just a mashing together of how we work together. That is another 1,000 state and county employees, but they're really administered and paid for by the state, and we've been working closely with the counties to ensure that they remain open.
UND held online forums today for faculty, staff, and students as the university operates remotely because of the COVID-19 pandemic. While fielding questions from faculty and staff, Interim President Dr. Joshua Wynn was asked if layoffs are a possibility.
We anticipate that people will continue, but there are uncertainties out there that we will just have to see as it evolves. But at this point, let me just conclude by saying there is nothing that is actively being planned on an imminent basis.
Classes at all North Dakota colleges and universities are being offered online through the end of the spring semester. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, serving 3 million consumers in 9 states with electricity from wind, natural gas, coal, hydro, and nuclear. Basin Electric Power Cooperative, striving to be your trusted energy partner.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. The Conversations on Healthcare podcast has proved to be a useful resource for us during the coronavirus outbreak. And today we have another excerpt to share as hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter talk with Representative Rosa DeLauro about the Families First and the Coronavirus Preparedness and Response Act, two bills to address the impact of the pandemic. Congresswoman DeLauro discussed the need for more resources for testing and health system support, the need for paid sick leave and family leave, the rise of telehealth to meet demand, and the need for the public to heed the warnings to stay home through the worst of the crisis.
Representative DeLauro, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much. And it's wonderful to be with the two of you. And we know that our community health centers serve 23 million people and oftentimes are the primary care facilities for patients. So we're there with you 100%. Yep. I promise you we're going to provide some more money for you in the third appropriations supplemental bill.
You know, we find ourselves in unprecedented times, and the coronavirus pandemic has taken hold on our shores, you know, really endangering the lives of so many, causing these huge disruptions around the globe, as well as here at home. The House just passed Families First in the Coronavirus Preparedness and Response Supplemental Appropriation Act, aimed at providing both health and economic protections for individuals and businesses during the ongoing crisis. I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners a broader understanding of exactly what these bills will do.
Sure. Let me first say to you, Mark, that and Margaret, we now have passed two bills. They are appropriations bills. What does that mean? These are the resources that the federal government is trying to provide to the individuals, to the institutions that are really on the front lines of this crisis. The first bill that we passed, which was about 2 weeks ago, was $8.3 billion. What did it address? It addressed mostly health needs, money for the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, so that we could get money to state and local governments about helping to have a public health infrastructure that could handle all of these efforts. Money for the personnel equipment and masks for professionals and first responders to be able to be safe. Money for the NIH, for vaccines, for research, et cetera. So mainly focused on the health side of the equation. And the second bill, which was just passed, it's a bill that focused on the economic issues that people are facing. It is about unemployment insurance. It is about paid sick days, paid family leave. It is about food security, making sure that families have enough of food at this time if they've lost their job or their kids are out of school. It also said that even if you're uninsured, the test for the coronavirus would be made free. So again, focused in on the economic issues for kids and for families. And it also included additional funds for the Medicaid program. Now, what we are in the process of doing is putting together a third appropriations bill for resources. That is in the making now, Margaret and Mark. And I've been on the phone all day with listening to various groups from the Red Cross to the American Federation of Teachers, from all the other education pieces. I've talked to the food security people. So we're going to try to deal with the gaps with both health and both economic.
Wow. I have a feeling you're not sleeping at night. What are you thinking about the ability of communities to grab onto these resources and run with it? Are you hearing from the groups you're talking to that they're prepared to spring into action when they get these resources?
I will tell you, I have had over the last several days, what I decided to do was to have conference calls with all of, and this is in the third congressional district in my communities, conversations and with professionals on the phone to help answer the questions. I don't know all the answers. I'll be very honest with you. So what we've done is to do meetings with chiefs of police by phone, with fire chiefs, with the superintendents of schools, with the heads of the colleges, heads of the hospitals, with the business community. You know, I did a teletown hall meeting the other night. It's the second one that I have done. Today, I met with the by phone the food security groups. They are ready. They are willing. They are able, and they are ready to go. What do they need? They need the tools and they need the resources. Obviously, resources being first, but also trying to look at how you look at some of the of the regulations, like on the whole food security area, how we make sure that we can ease the bureaucracy in order to be able to get food out to the to various sites, so that school kids, like we do in the summer program, can go to that site and they'll be able to get food. In some places, it may be that where it says that you that child has to be present, if we can have something that doesn't make it so that you have to do it, let's be willing to do it. One of the things I have to be honest with you that I hear, and I don't have a real answer yet, is the a personal protective equipment. Honestly, people are police, fire, hospitals, healthcare workers, even the soup kitchens. You know, if they've got people as volunteers and they're serving food on the sidewalk, they need to have protective masks. They need all of those things, and there is a shortage. I've been in touch with the appropriate federal agency. I was with them, talked to them last night, and they are struggling to fill the national security stockpile. But we're trying to do whatever we can in this direction. But I will tell you again, to go back to your question, Margaret, our agencies, our institutions are ready to do the job, and they have stepped up beyond stepping up.
Congresswoman DeLauro, I want to pull the thread on that thought of we need to do more around providing the tools and helping on the regulatory relief. With all these swiftly moving disasters happening simultaneously, some health protocols and regulations must adapt to meet increased demand of the health system. And for instance, we saw the Department of Health and Human Services is relaxing restrictions on telehealth services for the nation's 44 million Medicare beneficiaries in across the country in various states. Our state in Connecticut, but across the country, many are expanding telehealth coverage for Medicaid recipients as well. And hopefully this will expand even further. Just share a little more, like you did with food security on the health side, how these latest developments are so essential in both during the crisis and in terms of making our healthcare system more responsive and accessible to the population.
Now that's very good a point, because I am proud to say that in that $8.3 billion, which we first did, this is 2 weeks ago, it included provisions to allow seniors to access telemedicine services for coronavirus treatment. What I found from the school system and in our conversations is how do we deal with the access? How do we make sure that we are dealing with the access for kids, for seniors, for all of these, for healthcare professionals? And so that what we have to do is to look at what is it going to require? Mm-hmm. And I also heard this from the colleges, because their kids are online now. So. Right. Well, how is it that we are transferring both education needs and health needs to deal with, the telehealth efforts or the schooling by virtue of, telecommunications here? So let's take advantage of this moment and put some things in place that will allow us, when we get past this pandemic, that we have built into a system the kinds of infrastructure that allows us to deal with whatever else comes.
Well, Congresswoman, we have longer conversations to have with you about the way the relaxation of the rules around telehealth. And, part of that is we take very solemnly our responsibility to try to care for our own patients throughout this crisis, but to also manage in the community. People can be managed in the community without sending them on to the hospital, to the emergency room, to try and keep people from progressing on. Because we know from reading the statistics, and we saw some projections, that one of the biggest concerns, beyond the personal protective equipment even, which is a huge concern, hospital beds and intensivist beds, ICU beds and ventilators. And, we were noting the work of one of our good colleagues out in the state of Washington, just standing up a 200-bed hospital in a soccer field in a matter of a couple of days to try and rise to the occasion. From your perch in the federal government, you probably have a much better sense than we do about where we really stand as a country in the ability to rise to that level of the sickest people who are likely to be our oldest patients, but also younger patients, as we're seeing around the country. What are your concerns or assessment about our readiness for care at that acute level?
I have concerns. I won't sit here. I promised people when I spoke to them that I'm not an alarmist, and nor do I want to scare people. But I think that this is one of the areas where we have serious issues, and we have to be able to provide the increased beds, acute beds, for acute care patients I think at this moment that we are not there yet. And it's a direction we need to go in. I mean, for instance, look, I got a call from a hospice here in the Brantford area where they have 35 beds. Now, what they can't do is to take people with coronavirus, but what they can do is to help ease the burden. And what we need to do is, you know, look, the United States has an enormous capacity to put together, when we go to war, we build roads, we build hospitals, we build bridges, we do all the infrastructure that we need to support our troops in the field. This is our troops, the first responders, the health professionals are our troops in the field, our hospitals. And so what we need to do is to mirror that kind of production at this time. Mm-hmm. And I know our hospitals want to see it, and they're doing everything that they can to be able to take care of people, but they are feeling the shortage of both bed space and equipment.
We're speaking today with Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, Connecticut's 3rd Congressional District Representative. She chairs the House Labor, Health and Human Services, Education and Related Agencies Appropriations Subcommittee. You know, Congresswoman DeLauro, you were mentioning that you've been holding teletown halls really to address concerns and frankly, some of the misconceptions about this rapidly evolving crisis. We were fortunate to have about a month ago, Dr. Fauci, who joined us from NIH. And, you know, he was also talking about some things that have come to pass. For instance, even back then, he was urging the adoption of social distancing, but it's only taken on hold very recently with a number of states. We saw California today, New York, and just a few minutes ago, Governor Lamont in Connecticut put forward his stay safe, stay at home initiative. We're seeing a lot of mixed messaging, though, going on across the country. What must be done to improve vital public health messaging? Really, to, as you know, you're so close to the population, you're really an anxious public.
Yeah, it's a very, very anxious public. And I've listened to people on 2 teletown halls where thousands of people are listening and participating, or even just, you know, leaving my office last night. And a woman just said, you know, I don't know what to do. I don't have any sick days. I don't, you know, I'm frightened. You know, should I get a test? Should I not get a test? And first, let me just say, Anthony Fauci is the gold standard, as I think you agree.
Yeah, absolutely.
Looking at infectious diseases. And I try to take my lead from him in what we do in putting together our appropriations bills. But, you know, in some places, and I'll be honest, I was shocked to see on the beaches in Florida, a lot of our young people are their spring vacation. We ought to just say no. I mean, honest to God, we should shut them down because the young people seem to feel that they are impervious to all of it. And it is not true. It is just not true. So in some instances, you're looking at, you know, stay safe, stay at home. And that has got to penetrate the psyche of the country, which is not used to this. Americans are used to being out on the street, free, you know, you do what you want, et cetera. For the moment, we can't do that. And I think that both state and federal government have to be present in terms of making sure that the public is safe and have to take the precautions that we need to do that at this juncture. Mm-hmm.
You know, Congresswoman, we've been talking a lot about what the federal government can and should be doing for the American people and what the state government should be doing. This is government's moment, perhaps. But we also are always reminded of John F. Kennedy's ask not what you can, what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. Mm-hmm. And certainly you just highlighted the most important thing is those who are not essential frontline emergency responders, healthcare providers and like should stay home. They should stay home, take care mm-hmm. of their family, take care of their, you know, immediate contacts. But what else? What would you be urging Americans to do right now as we have to collectively come mm-hmm. together to get through this crisis? Do you have a message to the American people about how they can help, what they can do?
Yeah, well, I think they are, Margaret. I think the overwhelming instinct of Americans is say, how can I help
yeah.
in this crisis?
Yeah.
And they are doing that. Some are on a one-to-one basis in their own neighborhood. Maybe they're dropping off on a porch mm-hmm. food for someone or mm-hmm. saying, can I go to the grocery store for you? Can I go to the pharmacy to get your medication? What is it that I can do to be helpful? Can I be a volunteer mm-hmm. to drive with Meals on Wheels? And mm-hmm. obviously those people have to be vetted
sure.
and we have to take all the health and safety precautions, but people are really wanting
right.
To help to make a difference. And that is wherein our strength lies and where our strength to get by this pandemic, because we will. Mm-hmm. We will. There's no question in my mind. And it's tough going through now, and it's very, very stressful. But it's like all hands on deck. Mm-hmm. And while we are, and you know, you talked about state, the federal government, we have the obligation to provide the money so that we have enough pharmaceuticals, that we looking at the therapeutics, that we are looking at the equipment, that we make sure that people have the kind of income assistance that they need if they're lost their job and they're out of work, and what we can do in that regard, you know, in the short term. Their kids are out of school.
Right.
But let's really try to look to our own community, our own neighborhood, and say, how can I be of help to that person next door who may be less fortunate than I am, and provide them with some help? And that's happening. I think it's happening all over this country. Great. Be safe. Listen to what these health professionals, the scientists are telling you. Stay at home. Wash your hands over and over and over again. Take good care of yourselves and your family. And those of us who where we are, it is our moral responsibility to get to you what you need and to get to those professionals who are in your service. So this is a trying time, but it's one, as I said earlier, we'll get through it. We will.
Good. We'll get through it will be our mantra. We've been speaking today with Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, Connecticut's 3rd Congressional District Representative, about the coronavirus pandemic. Congresswoman DeLauro, thank you for taking the time to join us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you. Looking forward to the day when I can hug you guys.
We are
or at
too.
Least shake hands.
That was Connecticut Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro with Conversations on Healthcare hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Those conversations are produced by Community Health Center Incorporated of Connecticut. And the coronavirus stimulus package, which was referenced in the discussion, may pass Congress today. Decoded 8 Book is next.
COVID-19 has changed daily life in the U.S., and with news breaking by the hour, it can be hard to stay up to date. I'm Ari Shapiro. Join us every weekday for a new live conversation about the disease, what you need to know, what's coming next, and we'll answer your questions. The National Conversation with All Things Considered from NPR News.
The National Conversation. Listen weeknights at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Decoded 8 Book for March 24th. The early 20th century has been called baseball's golden age. According to one historian, from start to finish, through thick and thin, baseball persevered for these 100 years with resilient popularity and remarkably little meddling of its rules. Major League Baseball was coming into its own, but far from the roar of the big city crowds, baseball was a unifying factor in small towns across America, and North Dakota was no different. Baseball has been played in North Dakota for well over a century. Soldiers posted at Forts Abraham, Lincoln, and Buford passed what leisure time they had playing baseball. Homesteaders, following the dreams of claiming their own land, brought their love of baseball with them. The parts of Dakota Territory that became North and South Dakota battled it out for baseball supremacy before they even became states. As the railroads pushed across the Great Plains, the railroad workers relaxed with impromptu games of baseball. Fargo and Grand Forks began playing each other in 1880, and by 1883 they traveled for games in Minneapolis and St. Paul. By the early 1900s, virtually every city and town across North Dakota boasted a local baseball team. It was a source of community pride. But it cost money to field a team, and the course of small-town baseball did not always run smoothly. On this date in 1910, the Hope Pioneer was dismayed that the local team was on the brink of disbanding. The newspaper warned of the team's unnatural death this summer due to a lack of funds. The paper asked readers, "Do you want Hope to be a back number this year and have all the little villages around hurling challenges at us which we cannot call because of the lack of someone to take the bull by the horns and start things moving?" The newspaper did indeed spur local businessmen to action, and the town was able to field a team that summer. Dozens of Major League Baseball players have had ties to North Dakota. Roger Maris was certainly the most famous. But the importance of local teams should not be underestimated. The small-town team was a source of community pride and unity and offered a recreational break for early settlers. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
The number of coronavirus cases is growing, and so are fears that many healthcare workers will get sick. Now some states are making emergency changes to allow retired physicians to step in.
It's an all-hands-on-deck circumstance.
But some say the risks are too great.
This idea of bringing in retired doctors or nurses, I pretty strongly object to.
On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Wednesday on Main Street, the Great Plains Food Bank is one of the many organizations facing uncharted territory as the organization tries to cope with the consequences of the coronavirus outbreak. On our show Wednesday, we'll discuss how the crisis has affected demand, supply, and internal operations with Melissa Sobolik, Food Bank President. And the Heartland Marimba Quartet of Waterloo, Iowa is planning concerts in Grand Forks and Minot in the future. Prairie Public Music host Scott Prebus, a marimba player himself, we'll visit with the founder of the quartet, Matthew Coley, on our show tomorrow. We hope you can join us for Main Street. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.